that the gate remains open all day. Another point is, but he is not required to stand there all day. But he does have to be there to open the service, which is interesting. In other words, the Lord is going to make sure that these people don't think that the kingdom is a democracy. That's the problem today. We have just the opposite. Before, we had all strong rulers, Caesars and whatnot, and dictators and conquerors, and that's been the history of mankind. And the further you go back, the more individualistic it is, of sole monarchs. But now we're living in the day that everybody thinks they should do their thing and they have certain rights and prerogatives and so forth. But in the kingdom, they're going to have to respect the authority and position of the ancient worthies. It will not be tolerated that they try to do things of their own initiative without humbly waiting for the Lord's leading through them, and then, after that, initiative can be exercised when it's within the prescribed limits. And remember, we had that lesson not too long ago about Elisha, go to thou bald head, and how that curse came down upon the young men who ridiculed the ancient worthy pictured in that particular illustration. So this is another thing, that there will be deference given, and so he opens it and then he goes. And then it's left for the people's benefit to view. And they can look in now all day. They can't walk in, but it's open to view. See the information here. I mean, what could be more specific to tell you all these things? Now, we haven't had a reading of the next three. Sister Muhlenbrock, if you'd read, please. Four, verse four, three verses.
Oh, we're finished with the third?
Yes.
At the burnt offering that the prince shall offer unto the Lord in the Sabbath day shall be six lambs without blemish and a ram without blemish. And the meat offering shall be an ephah for a ram, and the meat offering for the lambs, as he shall be able to give, and an hin of oil and an ephah. And in the day of the new moon, it shall be a young bullock without blemish, and six lambs and a ram. It shall be without blemish.
All right. We've got three verses. See how beautiful that when we have had a background of tabernacle shadows, it comes in, becomes very valuable in understanding certain things. It's like a key that opens up a tremendous vista of information. And not only that, the familiarity with the Bible itself, let alone explanation of tabernacle shadows, but even with just the services, which is a great void amongst many so-called Bible students who know relatively little of the Bible, just of its fact. That is important too. Between the two, and that's usually one goes to one extreme and one goes to the other. One doesn't want to recognize the Lord's providential servant that he uses, and others, they think, well, let's go to the more important word, and they want to just study that only. See, actually, it's the combination. That, in my judgment, at least, that's the way I feel, that you use both. The Lord's Word is the basis of our faith and is the most important thing. But we should also recognize those that the Lord appoints, particularly these administrative servants, but special servants down through the Gospel Ages, the seven messengers. Now, we notice, though, that in connection with this worship, that the prince, the leader, it gives a sort of a rule of thumb method of a type of sacrifice that he would offer. And it introduces it in this way. Now, he takes as an illustration on the Sabbath day. Didn't we open up with that about, it says that the gate is opened only on the Sabbath day and on the new moons. And now it's going into another detail that when this Sabbath occurred, that it goes now into the information of the offering as to what happened. Now it says that prince that's there before the people, he then worships the Lord, and as a token of his respect and reverence to the Lord in connection with the services, he offers, and notice, six lambs and what?
And a ram.
And a ram. All right. Now, yeah, well, we've done so over the years, but not that frequently. So you can be excused if you don't explain that in detail.
I don't even remember.
But you notice this is backwards, life, which is interesting too. Which is the most important? The ram. The ram is the most important.
Yeah, the ram must be the peace offering. Got it?
Yeah, but you see, it's when you take the six plus the one is seven. In other words, the six in itself is incomplete, sort of an incompletion there. But then when it comes to the seventh, that completes the picture. And it shows the primacy of Christ is pictured in that ram, the primacy. He's the most important. And just like in connection with the gospel age, our own righteousness is considered as filthy rags, but that while we might have certain good motives occasionally, that the Lord adds to those motives the righteousness of Christ to make this service and worship to the Lord acceptable through Christ. He, as the head, makes the six complete, or as a robe, covers the infirmities of the body. And in the candlestick, remember too, there were these six branches, but the central stem, out of which the six grows, supplied the unity and the completion of the whole, and its acceptability before the Lord. So we find that sometimes the Lord, in trying to wake us up, as it were, along certain lessons, does like a speaker sometimes, that he states something backwards or in a different manner, just to lift it out of its prosaic description that you normally are accustomed to hear it, to say, note this, you know, where if you just say, oh, it's that same thing again, right away you shut yourself off, because you say, yeah, I know that. Because when you go to the Old Testament, you find this repeated many times, one way or another.
In the second verse, he says, burnt offering first, and then peace offering tutorial has to stand the other way around, doesn't it?
Yeah. I'm saying this is done from to wake up to a certain spiritual truth. Actually, the other way is the more logical method. But sometimes even our Lord in his parables stated things backwards or sidewise or unusual ways just to call your attention, to make you stay like on your toes as to what is the lesson here. See, it's just different. And I know a party who used to quote Muffet's translation, and there's certain parts of Muffet's that I always call it the Muffet translation, because he always pulled that thing out like we sometimes do with the Diaglot, and I got so tired of hearing Muffet, I call it the Muffet. But he had a way in certain scriptures of expressing things instead of in the positive sense, the negative. The same lesson, but by changing the phrasing slightly, where you're saying the same thing. I can't think right now off the cuff of an illustration, but it does do that. And it sometimes people pay attention. I never thought of it in that way. And yet you end up, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. It's just that sometimes we hear something so often, like the sun comes up over the horizon every single day. And so we don't necessarily take much time to look at that beautiful sun, because it's commonplace. It's become too common. The beauty of God's arrangement and how he lights up the earth and so forth, we're preoccupied. So sometimes to wake us out of our preoccupation, a thing might be done. like this. Right now we come to the, and in the law, in the Old Testament, in Leviticus, which came first? Which was the first sacrifice that's described in detail? Leviticus, the first chapter.
Burnt offerings.
Yes, good. And then comes your peace offerings, third or fourth chapter later. It doesn't come right away. You have your burnt offerings and then you have your meal offerings and so forth. But usually it precedes. Now, we go to another thing. And in the day of the new moon.
26.
Sixth verse. What is that? Sixth verse. It's be a young bullock without blemish, six lambs and a ram. Now what's this? All right, let's do it this way. What's the bullock represent?
Christ.
Jesus. I don't think so.
You think it represents both?
It represents
Jesus
both.
And the church?
It represents the Christ. The six lambs and the ram represent the Christ, but the lambs represent the church, which is nothing without its head, the ram. And the bullock represents the whole business as one animal. And we have been taught that in the Old Testament, even in Tabernacle Shadows, where if you study the eighth chapter and the ninth chapter, these offerings bring out this principle that sometimes the bullock represents only Jesus, and sometimes it represents both Jesus and his church. And in these chapters, they're kept separate because they're teaching us lessons, and rather than confuse us, we are like schooled in the ABCs of truth. And so in one chapter, the Lord uses one method. Then he comes to this other chapter and he shows the animal as representing the whole Christ as one animal, and that the head then of the animal would represent Jesus, and the rest, the trunk of his body, would represent the church. And that's a separate chapter. Now you have one where it's the bullock and other animals, and or the high priest and the under priest. They're separate pictures in the one chapter. And then in the other chapter you have only one, the priest. And he represents the under priest too. As the high priest, but of the whole Christ. And the under priests are left out of the picture because it's teaching a certain lesson in that chapter. They're kept separate. But now we're more advanced. We come now to where the Lord has taught us the one way. He brings them into one picture. He's now taking these two separate pictures and incorporating them in the one. He even did this on the Tabernacle Shadow arrangement. I haven't time to go into that now because that's a subject in itself. We get to go back into that and start reviewing that. But he begins little by little to insert a little lesson and it stops. But here, it's followed quite liberally. Now this is on when?
The new moon.
The new moon. All right. Now, you have the, what was the first one?
Sabbath.
Now notice the Sabbaths are more frequent. Sabbaths are, say, every week, weekly. Then we come to the monthly. See the orderliness of this. You have the, you take the week, and the month. Now it says this gate is closed during the other days. So it's saying something different now. This differs with the Mosaic Law. It agrees with the Mosaic Law. And it differs where there are certain lessons to be taught. And also to teach us, lest we get thinking that it'll be the same law. It'll be the same law under new arrangements, a new mediator, a new covenant, certain new details. It's just the principles of both will be the same.
And this was never practiced under
the
other temple.
Not this way. Right, now we saw like a week, but in this case, the month is emphasizing that the nation will be kept aware. There are certain things they have to have every single day. But there are certain periods of time where there's certain honors take place, like a birthday, say. A birthday is once a year. And then you have a commemoration on the birthday because you want to show you appreciate yourself. And so you take that particular occasion. or a wedding or whatever it might be. There's certain, but this particular day, the 30th, is the new month, new moon, and in connection with that, then we have him being honored in a special way.
You just finished that the nation will be kept aware of what?
I did, I don't know. I don't know about that.
In connection with the 30 years.
Oh yeah, about the number 30 itself. Will mean that all through all eternity, there are certain cycles that will be perpetuated. Even if the sacrifices stop, which we wouldn't be surprised if they will one day be terminated. I'm speaking about in the kingdom, that there will come a time they be terminated, but not in the kingdom to begin with, because they're described as happening there. But even if the day is dropped from the standpoint of the offering, it will remain as a day. Just like we have our Sabbath. The Sabbath day is always the Sabbath day. It never changes. It's always the same. So the new moons will be always the same, and each has its function. Now when it comes to the Sabbath, what does that represent? Rest, refreshment. And that's the kingdom. The whole creation groaneth in travail, waiting for the manifestation of the sons of God and the opening of this day, and that Sabbath day, in which they will get relief from the toil and burden of sin. But when you come to the new moon, that's a new start. That's emphasizing a beginning, rather than refreshment, a relaxation, and resting. The new moon is suggesting activity, even. As an opening, something new, a new era. And in that new era, Jesus is pictured by the number 30. So the lunar arrangement. He's pictured also by the 30 in the tabernacle, by the measurement when it's translated to feet of the altar, at the top of the altar. The perimeter of it. Now it mentions another thing which is of interest, that in connection with these, you see how much is packed in here, and I can't bring it all out because some of it I don't see, and some of it that I do see I need a model, because rather than waste time and breath, because as it is now we're going into a great deal of detail right even now just skimming through this one. In the account it mentions a certain principle in connection with the offering that is given. That is of interest because it's repeated elsewhere as far as the principle.
Yes,
alright, that's one. That's quite similar. And notice it doesn't spell it out because it assumes we know a lot. Does it? An heifer for a ram and the meat offerings. As he shall be able to give. Prorated according to ability. Now the ancient worthies in their perfection will be required, much more will be required of them than the people who do not have that physical perfection. But however, the ancient worthies, even though they're physically perfect, they're not perfect in certain details of their character because they've never had sufficient enlightenment. They're perfect as regards loyalty. They're perfect in loyalty because they've had their test. They've had it, they've had the test, and they've been proven worthy of being honored, so that part isn't the question. But they still have to, they have very little light, some of them, along certain lines. And they are under this covenant too, just like the people. The ancient worthies are under the new covenant, just like the people, because they will not be considered as released from that until the end of the millennium. Because they could commit certain transgressions.
So Frank,
may be perfect one way, but that doesn't mean you're perfect another way. Yes.
The meal offering and the oil was in proportion to the largeness of
yes,
the animal?
Yes, right. That was in proportion to the animal. The smaller the animal, the less proportion of the heifer and the hin of oil. These are quantity measures, and the hin is adaptable as a liquid measure, and the other one was, what was it, the effort is a measure. like in the old days when you went in the barn, they had these PET containers you put the grain in, and they were metal, a little metal bowl. You fill that up to the level, that's one PET. It's a dry measure. So the effer would be the dry measure, the hin would be a... Well, yeah, I think we had this, didn't we?
Is it like a horn?
A hin is like a horn, normally. But what happens, sometimes it would not be a horn except when it's symbolically used before the people. Now the people in their measures at home, like you have a kitchen cabinet, you might have something that says a hin, but it may not be shaped like a horn. It may be shaped like a vessel that's convenient for the cooking. But it's called that because quantity-wise, it agrees with the official hin, which is shaped like the horn, which is done from a ceremonial standpoint and pouring. Just like we have in the market food today, we have, it says 1 quart. Well, that quart can be almost any shape. But one thing is the same, it's about the same volume. It's supposed to be, anyway. It's supposed to be the same body. And an ounce is an ounce, no matter how it is. It depends on the... But that's emphasizing the quantities. And normally, in the old days, though, when you thought of a quart, you thought of a container that was familiar to which... It depends whether you live in the colonial days or later when they had the milk bottles. When they had milk bottles, a quart... Visually, immediately, there was the milk bottle in front of you. And glass. Now it's a paraffin-covered container. But you in your mind, conjure certain. Now we go back. In other words, that these offerings accompanying them would be the similar side offerings, just as in the Old Testament. It's recorded there. When you did a burnt offering, you were expected to bring along other things, like a flour offering, a little oil, and so forth, depending on what particular sacrifice it was. So here, this will be followed. So that while the day starts, a new moon, or Sabbath day, many of the details will be the same, and other details will be startlingly different. Quite different. Now, we read three verses. Brother Russell, please. Two verses, I think, because we have.
Which one did I?
7 and 8.
And he shall prepare a meat offering, an ephah for a bullock, and an ephah for a ram, and for the lambs, according as this hand shall obtain unto, and an hin of oil to an ephah. And when the prince shall enter, he shall go in by the way of the porch of that gate. He shall go forth by the way thereof.
All right. Now here's a case here where you have similarities of detail and differences of detail. And here you have, for a bullock and for a ram, the same measure. An ephah. Now, what would that be? See, I cannot say what I will say is true because it's conjecture, but I think there's a certain principle here as to why it states it this way. Instead of saying a third or a half or a quarter, it makes it the same.
As the ram, as Jesus is pictured in the ram, dry measure is full to that particular amount. And it's only the same thing in the bullock. It's just picturing Jesus and the churches have no part in it. I want to get
that. That would be a logical explanation based on the preceding verses where it says it's different than the law, but it's not different as regards the principles here where we saw that the ram represented Jesus as the head, or the Christ with Jesus as the head, emphasizing the bullock though, as the covenant. And you would expect a more complete accompanying offering, which is called a meal offering, or the meat offering, the same thing, meal, cereal.
and a hin of oil to an ephah. So the oil and the meal were both a full measure. Both a full measure, not fractional. However, when it comes to the lamb, it says another thing. It's another way of saying what? Yes, according to Ken, or use your own judgment. See, I mean, it's a way of saying that the law is not going to be that rigid.
But it was more rigid than the law.
It was, yes, it was.
Is it still as a support to the priesthood?
Yes, but it isn't as necessary. Because there's certain things in the future that we haven't even come to yet, maybe a little later, there's some other things about crops and things. The Lord tells us everything here. I mean, it's amazing. We just started, and we've only read, say, 7-8 verses, and already you're getting a tremendous detail. And this is only beginning now. It's now sort of winding up for the details of that day to give you an insight as to what's involved. This is a tremendous project affecting the whole nation. And remember, I think it was last lesson, we had weights and measures. The Lord gave us His standard in the kingdom, and not the metric, and not our English system that we're accustomed to, or the Chinese method of reckoning. But He has His own, and He puts it in print. Yes?
And this is most appropriate, because this is what the people in millennial have to live by. They'll have to have it, just like the Israelites had to have the old law. They have to have a book to refer
to.
That's right. To keep
them informed. So the ancient worthies function is more to explain certain things, personal problems and difficulties and administrative duties. But these little details, the people will be expected to get from the book. This is a textbook of the kingdom. And it's a very important one. But the ancient worthies will be there to ensure success to the ones who really put forth the effort. They'll make sure that they will get not the crown of life, but the garment of salvation.
Now, you didn't finish that why it was the same for the born from the land.
Well, the Esther more or less hit that on the head, that where the offering is of a nature to indicate the primacy of importance, say, a full measure was expected according to the importance of the service and of the representation. But then when it came to the other details, like in this case it happened to be 6 lambs, that judgment could be used along other lines. Use your discretion in other matters without spelling out every little iota. In other words, the Lord is going to emphasize not the letter of the law in the sense that where you're burdened down with a whole mass of detail. In the type it's necessary, because that type is going to be used later, way, way in the future, and I'm not speaking about the millennium. A million years after the millennium, these things are still recorded, and they're going to be used. And in that particular arrangement, they'll go back even to the Leviticus law again. In the kingdom, it's suited for the kingdom has its kingdom sacrifices. But when you're beyond the kingdom, then there are different things. Now you're beyond that, everything is settled, now it'll go back and review these details that have been omitted during the millennial age. I think the main preoccupation during the millennial age is the salvation of the people. That's the main objective. But in the future, when everybody has been saved, that are to be saved, and there's no more danger of dying, I'm not speaking the same, they're immortal, but they have passed their test. Now they have leisure, being that all were saved, to go back and now look over the details of even the older, not the Ezekiel now. To go back and start right.
Thus saith the Lord God, the gate of the inner court that looketh toward the east shall be shut for 6 working days, but on the Sabbath it shall be opened. and in the day of the new moon it shall be opened. And the prince shall enter by the way of the porch of that gate without, and shall stand by the post of the gate, and the priest shall prepare his burnt offering and his peace offering, and he shall worship at the threshold of the gate. Then he shall go forth, but the gate shall not be shut until the evening. Likewise, the people of the land shall worship at the door of this gate, before the Lord, in the Sabbath and in the new moon.
All right. Isn't this wonderful information? I mean, we're getting top secret information about how in the kingdom the Lord is going to conduct the religious services of that day. And as Bible students, we've shown very keen interest, all of us, in the tabernacle, particularly chapters 8, 9, 16, and some with a little less interest in Solomon's temple. But here we have very explicit information as to how God is arranging affairs in the kingdom. And the chapter then opens up with the observation that the inner court gate is only open one day a week. This is just a generality, because there are other certain exceptions. This is just laying down predicating a certain principle, because there are other holidays that don't necessarily fall on a Sabbath, you see, and they would be open for that holiday. It wouldn't fall on, we say, the last day of the week, but on some other day, and it's a big holy day, well, then that would be a different thing. But this is just an everyday formula.
How about the day of the new moon? Is that an extra holiday, too?
Every new moon is a holiday, is a service, a recognition, which is in the law too. It's in both the temple.
How often is that?
Every month. Every lunar month. We're not going into the calendar now, because that's a technical and a contextual subject, but we won't introduce that here, because there's a lot of other things that are quite interesting. Now, it's shut then during, like we say normally, the work week. During working days, if you can call it that, the kingdom. But when it comes to the day of worship, you notice the word worship comes in later on, the last verse that was read. It said that the people would worship at this gate. Now, in their worshiping there, what would their posture be? I mean, what would be some of the things they'd be doing there? Would they be in that gate?
And you worshiped at the threshold of the gate.
All right, now, I'm talking about the people. That will come to, too. I'm going to the end, because this gives you the picture, and then we go into certain closer detail. Likewise, the people
at the door
of this gate. Now, they cannot climb up the gate and get on that higher level where the inner court gate is. But they can go in front of the gate, close by the gate, at the entry steps leading up. How many steps were there?
Eight.
Very good. Excellent. Eight steps to go into the inner court. How many to go into the outer court?
Seven.
Very good. So if it's seven steps to go into the outer court and eight steps to enter into the inner court, why that extra step? That's right. We hear the expression one step beyond, in the yonder, the nether world, you know, in the mysterious realm, the spiritual realm, and that eighth step suggests that it's perfection, but one above it, one plus the seven, just beyond, yes.
Is there only the one door in the inner court?
No, but this door is the most important in that it's facing the temple direct. And yes, and this would be where you'd worship the Lord in a personalized way. This is not telling now about the Day of Atonement or something like that. This is telling about the new moons primarily, the more or less your regular religious holidays. But when that stadium is filled, when there's a filled to capacity, it can't all be by that gate. One thing, you'd have only a limited number of people. But during normal holidays, spiritual holidays, there wouldn't be as large a congregation as on certain special occasions. Now, in this case, where it was possible, of course, the people would like the front seat. When you go and you're a music lover, or you like to hear a certain lecture, and you want to get the expression of the speaker's face and get more atmosphere, well, you try to get up as close as you can to the front. So that being close to the east gate would be a real, not box seat, because that's usually elevated, but it would be a prime spot for observation because of its closeness to the altar, which is in the inner court. And you'd be close to see the scene of whoever is doing the officiating and so forth. So it would be a wonderful area to be. And now it tells that when the people come, they worship at the entry. In other words, the primary purpose is to look into and face the temple. And when it is possible to do this, this is what the Lord would expect, you to face him direct. I'm speaking from the standpoint of worship before his temple. They couldn't go behind him. That would be disobedience. It would be disrespect. Just like in Japan, the people go before the emperor. They go up to, they keep kowtowing, and they go up to his throne, and they have a talk with him a moment, and they back off. They never turn sideways or their back. Well, the Lord doesn't put a prohibition about sideways because there's certain practical aspects, but he doesn't arrange his structure for the backside part, for the public to be there. And so we find in Ezekiel's temple this is brought out very forcibly. Not here, but in constructional detail. Now, all right, here the people are to worship at the east gate, in other words, in the forefront. Just like the tabernacle, it was the east gate that was the most important gate, because it was the only gate too, as well. But it faced the front of the tabernacle, and then the Lord would appear to them in the smoke of the cloud, the pillar of the cloud, or by a voice, or through Aaron, or through Moses, depending on the circumstance and also the time.
Is that as far as they can get, the people?
On certain occasions, the people would be without, and their representatives would be able to go in closer. And so it tells in the Old Testament about the elders being gathered. Sometimes it uses the expression people gathered. I'm talking now about the tabernacle. But we wouldn't expect 2 million people on the Day of Atonement crowding into the holy and interfering with their services or any other big holy day. But what they do, the way they come in as a nation, is through their representatives. And so the nation of Israel had 70 elders. I'm speaking now about olden times. And these 70 represented the populace at large. These were their representatives. And they would go in and have a little closer contact because, say, Moses wanted to give them some instruction. Well, they're the most responsible people, therefore they should be the closest on hand to hear his message clear and bear the responsibility for carrying it out, whatever it might be. And so that way the people came in the court. They did not come in en masse. As individuals on off days, when it was an off day, they could go into the tabernacle as a personal sin they wanted or a personal thank offering. That's different than sacrifices on particular days in which there are ordinances that made it mandatory for the people to do thus and so. That's a different type of a sacrifice. So there's a communal gathering in which the nation stood outside the tabernacle court, and their representatives were inside, and the curtains would be drawn aside on the east gate so that the people could look in and be held. They would then be participants in a very practical way. In the temple, you have the same principle followed out. Now, these details are in the Old Testament, but they're so scattered and so minimally expressed, just in fragments here and fragments there, but when they're pieced together, you have the whole story. In Ezekiel, it's stated very succinctly and clearly that there's no mistake as to how it's done. Now here, they are before this entry to the inner court. Now if they're before the entry to the inner court, where are they standing then? This isn't a repetitious. They are located in the outer court. They're in the outer court, standing before the temple structure front, and as near as they can get. They want to be as close, and of course, those that are more diligent would get front.
And there's a gate between them.
And there's a gate behind them, and a gate in front of them. The gate behind them was the gate that was never opened. The outer gate. That's right. That's behind them. The inner part of that gate is open, but not the outer part. Backside, that goes way outside. The extreme, that door is locked.
So they have to come from the two sides.
That's right. They have to come from the two sides to go into the middle. Right now.
Brother, now that would be a rather large gate, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes. Sure.
So they could get a decent view, I mean.
Yes. Oh, my, yes. Yes, it's designed for that purpose. Whether they're before it or whether they're in the grandstand.
It still would take a limited amount of people, wouldn't it?
Yes, sure. But it's not meant to be. But when you have television, this can be seen all over the world. You get, and then there are some people who like to be on hand. Now, this is a vulgar way of expressing it, but it's the difference. Some people rather pay the cheap price and see a prize fight in a theater. But those who have the bug, they pay $50 or $100 to go right there to be close as they can to the ring. Well, that's in a vulgar or sport fad. But the Lord has his fans who specially are zealous of him and his ordinances, and they would like a front seat too. And they'd like to be on hand in, as much as possible. Not to honor themselves, but to be close to enjoy the instruction. In the account then, we've considered the first verse, but now as to the reason. But on the Sabbath it'll be opened. And in the day of the new moon it shall be opened. Now, why was it that that gate was closed and only open on the Sabbath? Let's take one thing at a time. See how beautifully this harmonizes with the truth. From a spiritual standpoint. Who is it that's looking in? All right, when will they look in? In the millennial Sabbath. It doesn't say that that at 6 o'clock the previous evening they're going to be crowding the gate at the first moment. But on that day, which normally would be at 9 o'clock in the morning, in the daylight hours, they'd be there, right? Because the Jewish day begins at 6 o'clock at night, right? Say it's a new day, and that new day, which begins at 6 o'clock at night, is a Sabbath day. Do they go to the temple at nighttime to observe the ordinances and the sacrifices of the Lord? No. They would go in the daytime. And it was in 9 o'clock in the morning. We've said this so many times, you're probably tired of hearing it. 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock are business hours of the sacrifices and the ordinances of the temple. It opens at 9 a.m. and closes at 3 p.m. So it's a six-hour religious observance day where the temple is in action for the benefit of the people. Therefore, when it says on the Sabbath day, notice that here you go all the way through the night into the next morning to 9 o'clock before they even go in. So you don't say that the moment that that bell hits the clock, bang, bang, they're there. See, many people in thinking and reasoning certain things, they want to be logical, they want to be factual, so that they have something they can grab hold of that's real, specific, and that's all. But you have to be a little reasonable on some of these things, and it was on the Sabbath day that they did go to the temple, that it would be open, but at the time of the normal service hour. So it's in the antitype. When we come to the date, 1874, this is the Sabbath day. We are already in the Sabbath day, but the people are not at that door yet. Because we have not come to the opening hours. The day hasn't dawned yet. It's still dark. Nighttime. See how these things begin to fit together without forcing. And so we find that just as in the actual practice under the tabernacle temple, so forth, and this one of the future, they're much the same. in many ways, except certain details. The general rules are generally applied, with a few exceptions. We find that, so here in the antitype, some saying, well, how can it be the Sabbath day? I don't see the resurrection of the dead. I don't see the Lord appearing here or doing these miracles there. Everything is predicated on the sudden act as far as the Sabbath day, millennial age beginning, where in the scriptures the time element is specific, but it doesn't start at its technical beginning. That's a peculiarity, and that's been a test all down the age. Now, when 9 o'clock comes, you can be sure that gate would be open precisely at the hour that it was intended to be open. And so the kingdom is going to start with real power and glory at the moment that God has ordained that it is to begin. But the day in which this takes place in the broad and technical sense may be quite a while previous to that. So we have the millennial day coming in 74, but the kingdom hasn't even been established yet. And the Lord has not yet appeared in glory. And you say, well, look, 60 years have gone by, 80 years have gone by, and many are getting frightened. Whereas in the type, we had a good portion of the day gone by. I'm not one that prorates the time hours of the day, because I don't think that's the principle either. There are ways of disproving that. But nevertheless, the Lord educates us with his technique of how he does certain things, and he is not sloppy or tardy as respects certain things, but we sometimes jump before the proper time. And then after a few discouragements that way, then we get lax the other way and not look forward then to the precise beginning. We make it general and vague. And so, all right, now we're back to the verse again. On the Sabbath day it was open. Now what's the next time? All right, now what's the new moon? The beginning of each month. And what is it? The new what? The new law covenant. At the time of the new law covenant. And that new law covenant, this part has not begun yet. The Sabbath day has begun. But the new moon, the new law covenant has not yet been established.
Somehow that'll represent every month?
This is repeated, yes. Just like you have a lot of sacrifices repeated. The Sabbath day, if you go back in Leviticus, the services of the Sabbath day were repeated every week for perpetuity. Every week. The daily sacrifice was every single day, no matter what day it was, that it was possible to do it. And the Day of Atonement and all did not stop it. This daily sacrifice still preceded everything. It was considered more important than the Atonement Day, because that's just showing something at a particular time of the year, having a particular lesson. But the other lesson of importance is that daily sacrifice. That being repeated day after day after day means that God wanted that such a primary, elemental matter in the Christian teaching. That the Christian going to prayer before the Lord with regularity. I'm just using the principle.
Yes.
There's several ways of viewing it, and that is very important. Now, back to the verse. Next we come to the prince enters by way of the porch of that gate without. Now, which gate? All right, that's half. That's 50%. Now that's the other thing. It's the east inner gate. Now, it says, though, that when he enters from the porch without. Now, it so happens that the disposition of the gates of the temple are very much like we normally picture in our minds. But the entrance into the outer gates, no matter which one it is backwards. Everything's backwards. Remember, we said the porch was on the inside. But when you come to the inner gate, the porch of the house is outside, just like we normally would expect it to be. And so you have a yard, and you walk into the yard, and then there's a stoop or a porch there in front of you before you enter the house. And so this porch, though, is like the gate. The gate is a combination vestibule and a porch. And in this case, the porch is without, that is, it's facing the outer court. And they walk up the steps of that porch, see, to go into the inner gate. That's the prince, not the people. And so when he says he enters in by way of the porch, without, he's saying that the porch of the inner gate, which faces outward toward the outer court, it's up those steps that the prince of Israel advances to get into the gate. All right, now he does that. He goes up into the gate. Then what? And shall stand by the post of that gate. Now, the constructional details show that one thing, let's just take the post, the significance of the post. What would the post be like today, say? What would be the equivalent? Yes, now I'm not talking about the literality of that post or pillar, but of what it represents. All right, not from a spiritual standpoint, but from a practical standpoint. For instance, say a person is a president and he's going to give a lecture. Does he stand on the ground floor in the auditorium? He goes up on a dais and he faces the nation or the Congress or whatever it is from a raised platform, and he addresses the people from this elevated position. And they can see him, and he is their representative. And especially in this case, he's the representative before God. He's the prince who is their leader, and he is at their head and instructing them in the leading the worship service, not as a priest, but as like one of them, but in a higher capacity, in a more elevated capacity. He had the privilege of walking up into the inner gate, which the people were not privileged to do. And this reminds you of somebody else who did that.
Well, the high
that seemed to break the law.
Oh.
Moses. Moses had certain prerogatives and privileges, even more so than the ancient worthies. I mean, than the in this picture of the kingdom. Moses went into the holy, didn't he? He could do certain things that only supposedly only Aaron could do. He had certain prerogatives and liberties because he was a special person appointed, and he was the one that anointed Aaron as God's special representative. And yet he wasn't the priest. He was like the civil representative of the people. And he was more prominent than the priest in that the priest did a perfunctory. He enacted a ritual, which was important to the people in that it showed their respect for God. But when it came to day-to-day instruction of practical things of life and commandments to give and so forth, that the prince, he governed the nation like a prime minister. And so, but in that case, Moses had certain liberties in connection with the tabernacle that other people did. He was an exception. And so we find that the prince in Ezekiel's temple had certain privileges up to a certain point which the people didn't have. This is a tremendous amount of knowledge in this whole subject, but the Lord certainly abundantly favored us with his information in the Bible, and it's a miracle how he's kept the, well, Satan has blinded the minds of men lest they see the glory of the gospel. But to think that it could be so precise, it's like a newspaper with all the headlines, and it's available all the time, and nobody knows about the headlines until the time comes. It's amazing. Just,
well, Frank, it says he will worship at the threshold of the gate, and the people will be at the door of the gate. So the threshold is beyond the door.
Yes, well, you go up the steps onto the porch. They can't go up those steps.
They didn't go up the steps at all. They just watched.
And then when he went up on the porch, that's the threshold. And once you go over that and enter, you go into the gate proper, which he was allowed to do. I don't know if it tells us right here. But he was allowed other liberties too beside this. But this is the most prominent spot as far as the people are concerned, not him personally. He had certain personal privileges that the people, the princes will have communication with the church in glory that the public won't know. They can have certain communion. It may be audible commandments. Maybe visual instruction. The public are not going to be given that privilege. But there are certain things that the minister, the covenant of the ancient worthies will do that they do a public function. Now in this, he's at this prominent spot, and it says by the post. Now in the Bible account in the Old Testament, we cannot just go and pinpoint these verses. This would be a 3 or 4 hour talk tonight, just to go into that part, and we don't want to do that until, unless the Lord willing, we have some more visual models and so forth to show the power of this. This is a tremendous thing. But here we find that it was a practice that when anointing, say, of a priest took place, or a king, the king was to be anointed, where did it take place? By the pillar of the temple. And there are accounts in the Old Testament that show that. In other words, there was certain prominence attached to one of these pillars. Both of them had equal authority, and because they're dual pillars. But one of them was used, whichever might be convenient for the occasion. There might be certain other things that are involved in connection with the mechanics in the court. You know, in the court there's a lot of activity by the priest and so forth, in the past as well as this of the future. And whichever is convenient, the most convenient, they would use the post. And either one of those would be representative of authority. And then anything important to be of note was done there. But he can't go into the temple by that post because he's not a priest. So he does the next best thing. He goes to the one that the people are closest to, and he's there before them, before the post of that gate, as though to say he's doing in principle the same thing that was practiced in the Old Testament. But that's as near as he could go to the temple. So he did it where they could see him publicly in this elevated fashion by a post. And also when it came to the judges. Where did the judges do their work?
By the gate.
By the gate and by a post of the gate. We could show the mechanics of that, but we haven't got the model. Just exactly where it would be. It's beautiful. How it fits the seat and everything. Where you could, how it could be done. Very, very real. Now, not, this is not a visionary thing we're talking about. It's all planned out any more than a room in a house. The floor plan is very practical, and you just look at it, and you, when you want to see that plan, you say, well, how beautiful, because this is the kitchen, this is the dining room, and you say, oh, that's just how convenient that is. You know? Well, the Lord's temple is beautifully modeled, beautifully arranged, to be practical and spiritual lessons, as well as practical application of them for the benefit of the people. All right, now, notice that in connection with his offering, what does it say here? The priest will do what?
Evidently, the priest provides the offering here.
Yes, in some occasions he provides the offering for himself, and some for the people as their representative. Now, it tells here, what verse were we reading? 3, all right. Oh, that's where we're going backwards now, to 2, right? We started with 3, because it was the people. Then we went to the prince. I went purposely backwards, because to give some groundwork to this, it's an easier method for myself to when it's a new subject. Now, he worships at this threshold, then he shall go forth. But the gate shall not be shut until the evening.